We started the Cyber 912 Student Challenge 3 years ago to try and bridge the gap between the really technical part of cyber and combine it in with national security, international relations, security studies thinking. What might be true at the technical level doesn't have to be true at the national security level, and vice versa. We need both of these to come together if we're going to solve the problems that are facing the United States and the world over the next 5, 10, 20 years.
This competition is for students to basically focus on some of the most important cybersecurity policy topics on an international level.
And we spend a lot of our time talking about technology. It really is a people issue. I was on the phone this morning with the CEO of a very large global company, and he's having trouble understanding it. So the fact that you all can get out there in the form of this competition and articulate these issues in a meaningful way makes me feel confident that the future is very bright.
It's been a wonderful experience, a unique opportunity for kids interested, particularly kids interested in this topic.
Just the international aspect of it and the law as it relates to, you know, conflict and just the policy. I guess interaction with the policy was what I guess interested me the most.
Being around a lot of grad students who sort of have obviously found this subject to be narrowing for them in a good way is interesting, and kind of hearing their backgrounds and what led them to be involved in this type of study is interesting.
When it comes to cyber policy in the United States, internationally through the UN, and just different ways that, the country's capabilities in terms of dealing with cyber threats and things, I've learned a lot about. And so that's been the most interesting aspect of it to me.
I'm very passionate about learning, and particularly cybersecurity. And it's my favorite field. And seeing that there is an opportunity that I can learn more in practice about cybersecurity policies, I wanted to try.
Here at the competition, being exposed to, leaders, both private and public sector, when it comes to policy making, is really impressive. They definitely have a lot of who's who here, and so that's been really exciting.
Working as a team has been great because we came from different areas. It's great to interact with all these teams, get to know what they're thinking about, like different perspectives.
I think what's been amazing this year is not just the quality and the breadth and depth that the judges bring to the table, but the breadth and the depth that the students do as well.
We've really got great geographic diversity. We've got schools from really all around the country. We've also got a great range of ages and backgrounds all coming together to give cyber policy advice and competing together.
To see all these folks from colleges around the country, grad students, undergrad, being presented with a realistic scenario of a threat based in real life, things that they may face once they exit school and go into government or company work, we're really training the next generation of cyber policymakers, cyber professionals here at this event.
And the students are answering questions that I don't think even in the professional domain, policy domain, we have real answers for yet.
Developing the scenario, we wanted students to have to face a wide array of different
Okay. Welcome to this part of lectures. I want to talk a little bit about firewalls and VPNs technology. You are all students of system administration and information security? Who is interested in information security of you? The most. Okay. So in former years we had a separate at system administration and information security. Now we have merged this. Has something to do with NTNU and the number of students. How many? Do you know how many students you are here in this course? Around 100. Wow. Okay. So I normally teach networking here, but I will leave NTNU. I will reduce my workload here into 20%. So my part will only be network security and a little bit about information security management, what is also the part of Stuart. It's not working very well. Okay. When we talk about security, we talk on the one hand on the technical side and we talk on the one hand on the more soft, we technicians call it soft side of security. What do you think? How many security issues can we solve with technological devices, issues, whatever? 10%, 20%, 100%? What do you think? Yes, of course you cannot say global value. 25% depends on the company. So when you go to the standard, and the standard for information security management is the ISO 27000 standard. Oops, the most common one. They say about 50% can be solved with technical solutions, 50% we need solutions in the organization with the people. We need to educate the people, we need behavior, we need awareness and all these kind of things. But I come from the technical side and I want to talk a little bit about technologies. But does anybody have heard about Bruce Schneier? Some have heard about him. He's a wonderful professor in Cambridge. And he's this number one competence guy in crypto and security. And Bruce Schneier said, if you think technology can solve our security problems, then you don't understand the problems and you do not understand technology. So keep this in mind during the next 3 years when you're studying information security. And don't think that we put some technology in place and then we are secure. But the problem will be, and this is what I'm teaching in the networking course, and what I also, is my experience from the outside world, when you consult companies or when you are working at a system administrator, you say to your boss, hey, give me 1 million kroner or 500,000 kroner, and I will set up a technological system, a firewall system, and an intrusion detection system, a prevention system, and some other technological, wonderful, twinkling things, and then we have security. And today, most of the CEOs, chief executive officers, so the bosses, the management, they say, okay, I have read about firewall is something we need. Okay, you get the money. And when you come afterwards and say, okay, I have my firewalls, I have my technology, but I need also money for education. I need money for awareness rising. I need money for auditing the things. What does the boss say to you normally? He said, you got 500,000 krona for this wonderful firewall. Why do you need more money? And this is the art. This is what you should learn in these 3 years, that you also have to discuss and have to overcome the boss. You need both. 50% technology, 50% other measures for security. And there are 50, 100 of possibilities to circle around the firewalls or VPNs. And when you do not take care that the people working in the company and the organization are aware about this, then your firewall system will be not working very effectively. But here in this course, I will talk about the technology. In the information security management course, you will also learn a little bit more around this. But of course, you should and can ask questions when you have to the things around. The question is, what is a firewall? Did anybody of you have heard about networks, how networks function? Do you know that the packet, the networks we're talking about today, the internet, are packet-based? Do you understand what it means? It's the same as, for example, you will buy a car, and normally you get 5,000 or 10,000 packets with pieces and a screwdriver, and then you get one packet after the other and you build the car. The internet functions like this. All our messages, including voice and streams, are sent as packets. Why do we don't have white? So, if we have a file, and we want to send it through the internet, then we put packets out of this. So we call it fragmentation. And all these packets need some information. And this we put here in a kind of header. And in this information, we have addresses, for example, so that we can address the packet, destination and source addresses, and some more information. About this kind of information, I cannot explain this within these 60, 70 minutes. I have time here. But during the networking course, you will learn about the structure of the packets, the way of the packets, the way packets will be routed through the network, through the internet, and all these wonderful things. But you need to understand the basics before we talk about firewalls. That the way the networks we're talking about looks like this. We have something like a file, a stream, whatever, voice stream, and we fragmented it into packets with addresses, with several headers. And when we talk about firewall, what does the firewall do? What is a firewall? Question again. When you consider this way of communication technology we have, what does the firewall do in this case? For example, it investigates the packets in any way we configure, and maybe he drops packets, he lets pass through packets, he is changing packets, firewall, whatever. So the firewall is dealing with these kind of packets. And this is doing in several ways. Of course, it is also dealing with streams. We have application-based firewall, we see a little bit later on. So this is the question, what is firewall? And at the second part I want to talk a little bit about is VPN. Make communication and public networks secure. Anybody have used a VPN? Few? Okay. So you have the possibility also to set up a VPN, virtual private network, from any of your devices here to NTNU. Set up a secure communication link between your device and the NTNU. We see this a little bit later how it works. So what I want to talk today is a little bit about AAA, a little bit about firewalls, a little bit about virtual networks. Don't worry if you do not understand everything in detail, because of course for this we have a whole lecture for networking and security. And when I go in detail how, for example, VPNs work and how security association will be set up and negotiation of passwords and all these things work, you need to understand a little bit more behind this. Does anybody have heard about Diffie-Hellman? Wow. So these are key exchange methodology And also, we have other things you need to understand. But let's start with AAA. AAA stands for authentication, which means verification of a claimed identity. For this identification, we have to establish the claimed identity. We have authorization, granting of rights or permissions for a system entity. And we have accounting. Accounting is tracking of network resources consumption and so on. And these, And this all is called AAA, authentication, authorization, and accounting. This is the three things we consider if we talk about information security. We need to understand this. It's a little bit more, but this definition is used here for accounting we have. So you should understand it. And how does it work? Well, the principle, what we have, the process of verifying an identity claimed by or for a system, is the authentication process. And this consists of two steps. The first step is the identification step. So we present something. Everybody is doing this more or less every day. When you log in into your system, you present something like a password, a user identity. Or if you go to the ATM, get money, you put in your Visa card. You present something. And then we have the verification step. And this needs some authentication information you give. And these are put together. Do you know what kind of measures we have or means for authentication we have? How can you authenticate yourself? Credit card? No, you have your credit card. And you authenticate that you will now want to get money from this wonderful machine. Password. What else could be a mean of authentication? Certificate, yes. What else? Biometrics, what's this? The fingerprint. Yeah, what else? Yes. So we have four means of authentication, and this is very important to understand. We have something the individual knows, a password or a PIN or something like this. We have something the individual possesses, cryptographic keys, tokens, something like this. Something the individual is, fingerprint, iris, something like this. And the fourth one is this something the individual behaves, how you walk, how you move, how you use your mouse, your trackpad, how you use your keyboard. This is the fourth mean of authentication. And Bian is working in this kind of biometrics, and we have a biometrics group. And when you're interested in this, we have a lot of experience here and ideas. So for network-based user authentication, the most important methods involve cryptographic keys and something the individual knows, such a password. So we have also multi-factor authentication. We can use more authentication means. Normally we need more than authentication means. For example, if we only put the credit card in the machine and it spends us 5,000 kroner, this is not very secure. So therefore we have a two-factor authentication. We put in the card and we have a second factor, which is the PIN. So ATM, bank card, we have. And PIN we know. Password we know, plus one-time password via SMS, for example. So this is something we know, and the one-time password via SMS is something we have because the SMS will only arrive on this mobile and not on all the mobiles. It's hopefully not a broadcast. You know what a broadcast is? Broadcast is a message to all. So what I'm doing here is broadcasting. And if somebody of you is talking, this is a unicast. It's also important to understand what networking is. Fingerprint, you are, face, you are, and so on, and so on. Now let's go to firewalls. Firewalls and intrusion prevention systems or intrusion detection systems are very often similar. Does anybody know what an intrusion prevention or detection system is? That anybody has worked with intrusion detection system? Okay, intrusion detection. This is only a short detour. I don't go in detail in this because this is the next lecture. Intrusion detection systems are invented or developed to find out if there is something in my network abnormal, not in the way I expect. So, for example, if we have an allergy with the traffic outside, in the morning at 8 o'clock or between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, there is a lot of traffic here in Jørvik around the roundabouts and towards Raufoss, and many cars are running there. And the same in the afternoon between 3 and 4:30, something like this. So, and in the evening, there's normally nothing. And during the day, there is strong reduced amount of traffic. So what does an intrusion detection system do? It's looking about the traffic situation. And if it is always like this, a lot of traffic in the morning, a lot of traffic in the afternoon, and the rest of the time is more or less quiet, the intrusion detection system detects maybe on a Wednesday, 12 o'clock, a lot of traffic. So there's something not normal. And exactly this is the intrusion detection system doing in our networks. It's observing the network traffic, the way the traffic is going, maybe destination and source addresses, maybe the number of packets on several links. And when this is in a normal way, nothing happens. And when there is a lot of traffic on one link to an unexpected time, the intrusion detection system assumes maybe there is an illegal download or there is an illegal kind of communication or whatever. So intrusion detection systems detect unusual, abnormal traffic behavior in our networks and react on this. And the way it reacts and how it reacts and why it reacts and why so many administrators switch off the intrusion detection systems, this we will learn in the next semester in the network and network security course. But you should understand or should go take with you, intrusion detection and prevention systems are something like the big eye looking on the network and detecting unusual, abnormal behavior within our networks. And firewalls very often work together with these intrusion detection systems. This is why I mention it here. But let's concentrate on the firewalls. So the principle is a secure solution that protects the entire LAN from external attacks. What is a LAN? Local area network, right. So it's a local network of a company. We want to protect the company, and we put a firewall in front of this or on the border of this, and it's a security solution that protects this against external attacks. It's a single choke point where security services can be imposed. Of course, when we have a local area network, we will not disconnect it completely from the internet, for example. This would be, by the way, the most secure way. Switch off our local area network, switch off your smartphone from any network connection, and then you are secure, more or less. But this is not the way the behavior we want. And therefore, we need some devices which gives us the possibility to allow dedicated access to our web servers, for example. We, of course, want that other mail servers send email to our mail server so that there comes mail inside our network and goes outside of our network. We also want to have some communication, streaming, whatever, or a Skype call, bidirectional communication, and therefore we need any security instance which allows us to configure this kind of communication. Prohibits potential vulnerable services from being exposed from outside, and implements other network functions like... This chair is not fine. Like NAT. What is NAT? Heard about NAT? Network address translation. Has anybody heard about the IPv4 protocol? Internet protocol? Does anybody heard about that, there is a number of addresses we have. How many addresses do we have with our IP version 4 addresses? 255? This is a little bit less than we only have 255 servers all over the world. This is too less. The IP version 4 protocol supports about 1.4 billion addresses. So, what do you think? Is this enough for the whole world? We are already ran out. So we have a lot. How many people are living on this wonderful planet? About 7 billion, yes. It becomes more and more. So we have 1.4 billion IP addresses. This could not work. So we need, and then, but we are working with this Internet Protocol version 4 with 1.4 billion addresses. And what we do is something called NAT, Network Address Translation. And this means we have this wonderful network. Maybe this is NTNU. We have a router outside, which is connected to the internet. And what this router is doing, he is translating the addresses from here to here. And here we have something called private addresses. Internet addresses. And these private addresses will not be routed in the internet. So these private addresses, for example, are, maybe you know this, 192, 168, 10, 10. Has anybody seen address like this? Is anybody using an address like this? You're using. This is a private address, 192. Another private address space is 10.0.0.0. And these addresses will not be routed in the internet. So here, if you send a packet with a destination or source address of, for example, this, there are some more available, the first router in the internet here will drop the packet. The idea behind this is, here within the private network, we can use these kind of addresses, but here, at this point, here we have an official IP address. And this guy, this device is doing NAT. So here we have NTNU, 40,000 private addresses. And they will be translated into one or some more official addresses. You can compare this with telephone numbers. We need clear, single, unique telephone numbers if we want a telephone. Of course, when I want to call you, I need your telephone number, and when I dial your number, I have a connection to you. This is the official IP address. You can imagine that you have also private addresses, telephone addresses within an organization, which is not routed from outside. And exactly this is the way how this address translation, network address translation works. Also, this you will learn in the networking course, and you will also configure this in the NetLab, in the Cisco lab. Has anybody been down in the A058, in the Cisco lab? It is also the base room, I think, for you. And now something for me. You're not allowed to eat and drink there. And the reason for this is, I tell this so often, is when you go with your pizza and your tomato sauce on your hand and then you use the keyboard and the next one comes with cheese on his hand is using the keyboard after some days or weeks, nobody wants to touch this keyboard anymore. And then we cannot use the lab anymore. And I don't have the staff to clean this and I don't have the time to clean it all the time. So please eat in the canteen and work without eating in the lab. So in this lab, you will configure NAT. This will be one task also in an exam. Then we have IPsec and VPN. These VPN, I'll tell you a little bit about these. This is based mostly on IPsec. We have also TLS VPNs. This is something for later. You also will realize this in the NetLab later on. So firewall goals. All traffic passes through the firewall in both directions. Authorized traffic is allowed to pass, other will be blocked. The firewall itself should be immune to penetration. And this is very important if we have something like a firewall. And the firewall normally is also placed on the border to the rest of the network. We have to secure the firewall. Because the best way to attack a network is to attack the firewall, get access to the firewall, and from there on we have access to everything. So you need to protect your firewall. It must be immune to penetration. And attackers will try to get in. Firewall limitations cannot protect against internal threats. When you imagine the firewall will be here and is protecting against all these guys from the outside. And don't believe if somebody comes and says, all the bad guys are Chinese and Russians. This is not true. There are also other ones. From the good countries, for example. NSA and what they are called have also a lot of interest to get in networks. So the firewall protects against this. But what would happen if someone is sitting here and attacks the network? And this is not only the point that they're someone from the Russian Secret Service or NSA or whatever is placed in this, in your private area, in the company network. NTNU maybe is not so interesting because this is a more or less open network. But if you think this is, for example, the network of, I don't know, a company dealing with rockets or with cars, Porsche or Mercedes-Benz or something like this, they want to protect their network. And there are, of course, some organizations are interested to bring in people into this network. But this is only the one hand. The more critical people attacking a network from inside are the workers itself. So someone who is not satisfied anymore with this company. Someone who get fired and has another week to work in the company. So these are the people. Are dangerous inside. People are not getting enough money, something like this. So the attacks come also from inside. And firewalls, normal firewalls, will not protect against these internal threats. Attacks can bypass the firewall equal through improperly secured wireless LAN. A very good trick is to set up a wireless LAN access point here anywhere in the plug of, here's nothing, but in the network plug. You have an access point, and when the network plug is not secured, you can log in from outside to this access point. Then you're in the network, and you're an insider. So against this, firewall cannot do. In fact, portable devices can be plugged in and be used inside. And this is the most critical point. Today, most of the people are working at home, in the plane, on the train, everywhere. They have their mobile devices, notebooks, tablets, smartphones. And these smartphones are interconnected here to the internet everywhere, in the hotel, on the airport, in the bus, in the train, everywhere. And then the firewall system we have to protect our private LAN will not work in the internet. But these guys come sometimes back to the company, connect to the network, have a virus, a worm, other malware on their mobile devices, and this will be spread in the local network. So against this, a firewall could not work because the device infected from the internet will be carried into our network and will bring in the malware. But of course, this means not that we should not install firewalls. And especially for this, that people go in with devices in our network, we need rules, we need policies. We need to train the people how to work with the devices. What is allowed to download, what is not allowed to download. What kind of application is allowed, what is not allowed. And then we have this wonderful problem somebody has heard about this here. When you hear my lectures, you will hear about this very often. What does this mean? No. Bring your own disaster. Of course, device is right, but this is a disaster. Because, story from my home, when I had my first iPad and I brought it at home, I had a 7 years old boy. What do you think? Who was the first one taking the iPad and disappeared with it? My son. And this was an iPad from my company, from the university. Well, what do you think? You have your first salary, you buy an iPad and say, okay, I want to connect it to the company network. And then the administrator says, you are not allowed to install any app without consulting me. You are not allowed to install playing games or something like this. They say, but I paid for my iPad. Oh, but it's bring your own disaster. If you want to use it in the company, you are not allowed to do anything. This should be done under the view of security. But of course, if you buy your own mobile device, for example, you will not accept it. So my proposal is, buy your private device, do what you want, and the company should give you a device, and then the company can say what is allowed and what is not allowed. That's okay. But the clear point, bring your own device and mix this, not a good idea. So back to the firewalls. We need firewalls, of course. And where should we place firewalls? And this is something I always teach the students, and I was thinking about that students and people working in companies knows this, about this. But I found out some weeks ago in a company that the plan of setting up a firewall was completely wrong. I tell you, or I paint it a little later to you. First, let's say where we place firewalls. The first one is to put a firewall onto a host-based firewall. This is some software running on the server or on the client, whatever, on the system, and is defending our system. So the most operating systems today offer host-based firewalls. Who is using a host-based firewall on the notebook? Mac? Every Windows system has a firewall. Every Mac has a firewall. Linux has a firewall. Did you use it? Did you configure it? Hopefully, after 3 years studying information security, everybody is doing that. Okay, this is located here. On servers, sometimes we have a dedicated host-based firewall. You have any idea where we can run a firewall on a host, where on a processor, which has a lot of power and is also often not used? Has anybody heard about GPUs? Graphic processor units? These are processors, very high performing processors, only used mostly for computer games and something like this. So something no one uses, nobody needs. I think so. But on servers, we don't need this, of course. Maybe you are using it for your computer games. But on a server, which is running down in the basement, where it's dark and nobody is sitting before, this GPU is useless. But we can put firewall software on this. The two advantages are it's high performing and it's outside of the central CPU. So it's running completely independent. So if an attacker attacks the CPU, the attacker will not detect immediately that there is another supervising GPU watching him. And this is an advantage. So on servers or on devices, sometimes it's a very interesting thing to use these graphical processors for firewalls. Okay, then we have the single bastion firewall, which is a very often used one. This is the typical way used in home office and home areas. Maybe you have it at home. Who has a DSL router or something, a router at home? Some of you, and you mostly have, this is the router to the internet, and mostly on the routers, firewall software is running. Also, this, of course, you can switch it off, but you should not switch it off. This is a typical way for home offices. In small and medium enterprises where we need, for example, devices which have access to the internet, we have this single bastion T firewall. What kind of, it's signed here. So web servers, mail servers, DNS servers, they need access to the internet. What is DNS? Domain name system. DNS server is the domain name system server. What is the sense of a domain name? What is a domain name system? First thing, I don't like it if somebody says IP when he or she means IP address. So, for example, please give me your IP. Okay. Please give me your telephone. I want your telephone number. So nobody says give me your telephone. Telephone number. IP is internet protocol. And what you want is the IP address. So if we talk about in this environment, we talk about IP addresses. Please do this. Okay. Domain name system is translating between IP addresses because they look like this. And then we have something like IP Internet Protocol version 6. Has anybody seen an IPv6 address? Can anybody remember an IPv6 address very easily? Because they are mostly in hex domain notation. They have 128 bits and it's not so easy to remember this. But also these addresses are not so easy to remember. So this is the reason that we have, or the internet society, the internet community has developed domain names. And these domain names are mapped to these addresses, or IPv6 addresses. So we can very easy remember the domain ntnu.no, because this is our university and it is in Norway. but the IP address for this is not so easy to remember. So, but we need something, and this is a domain name service, which is translating it. So we, for example, if we start a browser and we say www.ntnu.no, what does the browser do? Back to the packets. Do you think in the header of the packets there is domain name information? You remember some domain names, they are very, very long with all these extensions behind this. So we cannot put them here. So what the browser is doing, you put in www.tnu.no. The browser, the application, is asking the next domain name server, anywhere here or where it is, please give me the IP address for www.ntnu.no. The domain name server returns the IP address, and then the browser uses the IP address to access the server. This is the idea behind this. So you could never act or do anything in the internet without DNS. If someone is driving down the domain name system worldwide, everything is dark. Or do you know the IP address you have to put in if you want to get the NTNU site? Who knows this address? I doesn't know it as well. Or when you want to get money from your DNB bank, do you know the IP address of your DNB bank server? No. So, if there is no domain name system, there is no money anymore. That's a point, domain name system. And this domain name system, of course, needs the information from the outside, because domains appear and disappear and so on. What is the most popular DNS server address? Exactly. 8.8.8.8 is the Google domain name server. So if you do not know the domain name server of NTNU, whatever, a local one, this one normally works. But if you don't have connection to Google, then you don't have a domain name service. Okay, this is the sense of the single bastion T firewall. That we have some devices have access to the local area network, and some devices in the internal network. So what is very important is that this network is completely separated from this one. Because if someone from outside accesses the mail server and there is any flaw in this, and yesterday I had a lecture in the master course about Heartbleed. Anybody have heard about Heartbleed? This is a flaw in the OpenSSL library which gives you information about passwords, whatever, so if you use it in the right way. So if you have the possibility to access a server here where the Heartbleed flaw is not fixed, you get access maybe to the server because you get file passwords and something like this, user accounts. You log in this password, and when you have a link between this network and this network, you can directly access this network. So you need to separate this kind of network, and we call it sometimes demilitarized zone. I don't like this because it's too much military-based, this name. So mostly this is also called perimeter network. So when you hear perimeter network, it is exactly the same as the DMZ. So, and if you want from the local area network access the mail server, web server, DNS servers, you always need to go through the firewall, and the firewall rules must allow this or not. So this is the way it goes. And I saw 3 weeks ago a network structure where here between these two networks was a link. And this should never be, never ever, should be a link between the perimeter network and the local area network. There in always, all cases, must be any security device, like firewall, packet filter, whatever. You need to secure this. Okay, then we have some more infrastructure ways. We can put a choke firewall between these secure the DMZ against the external firewall. And when you set up a firewall or two firewalls, what is recommended? To use the same firewall system or to use different firewall systems? Different. Why? The point is, if here is a flaw, somebody gets in here, and you have the same here, it's very easy to get through the whole thing. It's the same with virus, antivirus software and so on. If you have different system provider, the security is increased. The problem in this is that maintenance is more complex because you need to know the operating system of the one vendor and the operating system of the other vendor. You need all information from the one vendor and from the other vendor. So you have a more effort to maintain the systems. But from the security issue, it's a good way to use different ones. Okay. And then the double bastion T is that we have the external firewall, here the DMZ and the choke firewall. yes, these are the firewall infrastructure or where we set it up. What kind of firewall types we have? I only go shortly in detail because therefore we need to understand this kind of packet-based communication we have in the internet. So we have packet filtering firewalls, we have stateful inspection firewalls, and we have application firewalls. These are the three ways, and I go through it. Packet firewalls applies to a set of rules for each incoming and outgoing packet. So the classical packet firewalls take the packet, look into the packet, and evaluates it's allowed or not. That's it. In or out. Based on a set of rules, is for this, the packet is accepted rejected. The filtering rules match on packet headers at different layers, so each packet will be evaluated. And here we see one disadvantage of this packet-based firewalls. If we, for example, have a stream, video stream, it is enough to investigate the first packet, and when this is allowed, the other billions of packets could be passed through. But a packet-based firewall is investigating each of these packets. So each of these video packets come in will be investigated. And this is not in every case necessary and drives down our network. Now, What will be investigated? We will investigate the firewall on a dedicated network interfaces. It's looking for MAC addresses. It's looking for source and destination IP addresses. This we talked about. What is a MAC address? Computers have hardware addresses, media access control address, MAC, and IP addresses. So we configure an IP address on a dedicated interface, but this interface has also a MAC address. If we talk about layered, the OSI reference layered communication, you will learn later, we will talk about this. Only some words to the MAC addresses. The MAC addresses are assigned by the manufacturer of the network card. So every Ethernet card in this notebook and every wireless LAN card has a MAC address, and the half of this MAC address is depending on the vendor and the other half is assigned by the vendor. So this is a unique address. Every MAC address is unique and is assigned by the vendor. So this assumes, oh, MAC address is fine, this is unique, we can use it for security. Is this a good idea? No. Because it is possible using software to change this MAC address. So it is not hardly burned into the interfaces. So you can change this kind of MAC address. But this we learn later. Don't take care of this. We look also on our packet about protocol, IP protocol fields. And this is not completely right. It's not internet protocol field. It's a protocol above, like TCP, UDP, ICMP. These are transport protocols which take care that our packets will be delivered in the right order, in the right way. These protocols take care whether if the packet is not delivered, it will be resent and all these wonderful things. This is an extra lecture. We talk about this later on. But the firewall is able to investigate these kind of protocols. It is able to investigate port numbers, and port numbers are according to applications. For example, maybe some of you know the port number 80. What kind of application is the port number 80? HTTP. And then you know maybe the port number 443. What's this? H. HTTPS. It is SSL, but it is HTTP with SSL. And this is what we normally use when we have a secure encrypted channel to the web server. How it works later on. And here Heartbleed is infected. Okay, these port levels, this is addressing the application. This could be investigated. So the firewall can say, okay, I do not allow poor HTTP traffic through my network, but I allow HTTPS. So it can look into the packet and see, okay, there is a destination port 80, I drop the packet. Oh, there's a destination port 443, I allow the packet. So this is possible. Then with TCP flex, SYN, ACK, FIN. This takes me an hour to explain it, but you will learn this a little bit later. It will also look for ICMP messages. Does anybody know ICMP messages, what it is? Did anybody use an ICMP? ICMP stands for Internet Communication Message Protocol. What kind of application or command many of you already used ICMP? Ping. Ping is a typical ICMP command. Ping is nothing else than I take a table tennis ball, throw it to you, and it comes back. And this is what I do with another machine, with another device. I send a packet to the machine, and the machine sends it back. But what could happen is, if somebody sends millions, billions of ICMP, of these ping packets, to a web server, this web server will be completely overloaded, and you drive it down. This we call denial of service attack, because you send something to the server and it goes down. So it could make sense that the firewall drops ICMP packets from outside, from the internet. From inside it's allowed, from outside not. Okay, how do they work, these packet filters? Well, firewall rules are typically organized as changed access control lists. And this is what you will, if you are in the networking area, you will hear all the time. ACLs, access control list. How to configure ACLs. And ACLs are not so funny. From the principle, they are very easy. But if you configure ACLs in a way that they do what you want, what they should do, there are millions of possibilities to make faults. And you will do this, and you will learn how to do it, and you will also make your experiences with access control lists and fails. The first rule that matches a packet is an effect, and then it stops. So this means if we have here an IP packet, it comes to the firewall chain, to the rule set, and the first match will be matched, then it will be accepted and the packet will be transferred. All the following rules will not be processed. This you should learn. So for example, if you say, okay, I allow an IP packet with the address 192.168.10.1, and it is allowed, the packet will be passed through. When you have a second rule where you say, okay, this address is allowed, but port 80 is not allowed, then the second rule will not processed. So what you have to do in this case is you must put first the rule port 80 and then the IP address. This you learn also in practical a little bit later. If no match to any rule is done, a default action is realized. And on the Cisco routers where we are working with, we have the deny by default rule. So every rule will be processed, and if no of the rules is true, the policy is deny any. Again, throw away the packet. There is another possibility, but it is less secure. If no of the rules will be match, the packet will be accepted and passed through. But then you have no control about this. Then we have stateful inspection firewalls. This packet firewalls is only working on these kind of packets. But we have also stateful inspection firewall. This is connection tracking. And this is exactly what I meant here with the stream or with a HTTPS session. The stateful firewall maintains the state of information for each ongoing exchange. This means there is a stream, the stream is detected, and then every following packet will be passed through without any information. We have a web interconnection. We ask the web server to give the information, and the web server is answering, and then we have a connection between the web browser and the web server, and all this exchange of packet will be passed through because the status of this connection is proved. Packets can be accepted based on the fact that they belong to the established connection, is what I meant. And this is important for all TCP-based services. You will learn this next semester. Can be implemented also for UDP. This is important because the DNS relies mostly on UDP traffic. The difference between this, in short words, is TCP is a connection-oriented communication. You see, we have packets. With packets, we send the packet out. There is no connection. There is no band on the packet so that we have a connection to the other side. TCP works in a way that after a dedicated time, I get an acknowledgement that the connection is still running. So I have a virtual connection-based communication. UDP is completely different from this. UDP is only sending out and no interest anymore what's going on with the packet. The sense to have these two protocols is when I want to transfer maybe a file which contains an operating system, I need to be sure that every bit is transferred because I cannot install the operating system if some bits or some packets are lost. If I transfer a video stream, if one or two packets get lost, normally the video player will compensate this problem. And it makes no sense to send the video, the packet of a video stream 5 seconds later. What should the video stream do with it? So, and the idea behind this is this UDP for streams, for example, is less complex. And TCP is much more complex. It's more effort. We have always the recommunication. So this is why we have these two protocols, TCP and UDP. More details in the next lecture. Stateful firewalls work in a way like this. Here is an example. Web access as a client, unrelated incoming packets with source port 80s will be blocked. This means we have on the web server the TCP protocol. We have the source address, which is our address, every source port, the destination address, every destination port, flex we forget. If this connection is established, it will be allowed. This means we send any packet out with our source address to anything, it is allowed. If we get a TCP connection established, it's also allowed. And all the others are denied. I hope this is not part of the exam, this kind. Maybe someone in understanding this kind of rules. One, two, three. You will learn this in a practical way in the networking course. This gives you only the information, okay, we have an established or new connection. The status is part of the firewall rules. And then we have application proxy firewalls. This is a simply clear way. We have applications, and these applications are... will be used for the security. It acts as a relay of application level traffic. So when we have an application, we build the connection to the application firewall. The application firewall checks whether I'm allowed to make the connection to outside. And then instead of me, this proxy application firewall is setting up the connection and delivers the data to me. So we have the possibility here on application level to filter all traffic. We have the possibility also to check what kind of information is going through. But we have a problem with this. What's the problem with application level? When we want to have a web access with this wonderful 443 protocol, we have... We have a web browser, start HTTP. To the web server. And when we start HTTPS, all the traffic in both directions is encrypted. How it works, we learn later. It's encrypted. If we now, for example, have our web client here, start the connection to the application gateway, and the application gateway is running the connection, the application gateways must decrypt the traffic. And this will not work so easily. So we are not able to set up an encrypted interconnection using application proxy firewalls in a simple way. There are some ways possible, but this makes it a little bit complicated. But take into account application proxy firewalls are a problem for end-to-end encryption traffic. It's optionally providing authentication information. And the proxy contacts the application on a remote host. This is what it, how it works. Application proxy gateways, the benefits, can inspect application data beyond the capability of traditional or stateful inspection firewalls when it is not encrypted. Can check mail attachments, can check web traffic, and can provide user authentication. So proxy firewalls have a lot of possibilities, but they are complex, and they are mostly not compatible with encryption. And this makes it a little bit difficult. More about this a little bit later. Yes. This was the point, firewalls. I can say a lot of more of these things. Firewalls are very complex. To set them up is complex. We have the possibility here in the Cisco lab to implement firewalls on the routers in form of access control list. We have also real firewall boxes you can configure. You have a lot of possibilities to do this. Do you need a break? 5 minutes? I think many of you are alone. Okay, let's have a 5 minutes break and then we are back in. Okay. Let's go. The last point. It's the virtual private network. So firewalls, I gave you an overview. If you do not understand everything of these, don't worry. You will learn this in the next semesters. It's not a problem. It should only give you a little bit of view on security appliances like firewalls, where they could be installed, how they, from the basic work, but in detail we go a little bit later on. But take into mind, this is not more than 50% of the security issues you have in your company or in your organization. You need more. Okay, virtual private network is another technology to access networks in a secure way. The definition is, a virtual private network is a network infrastructure where networking devices of a private infrastructure are communicating using a public network, equal to the internet. The networking devices share the communication link with other users, but they have the illusion that the network is used by themselves alone. This is the definition of a virtual private network. And how does it work? Well, we have a virtual private network. We have a network, whatever it is. Mostly, we talk about the internet when we talk about VPNs. This network, we have virtual connections through this network. Because, of course, we cannot acquire a dedicated link through the internet from the internet service provider. We can buy a link from maybe Telenor from here to Lillehammer. Then we pay a lot of money. We have only this link, but we have no connection to anything else than between these two points of the link. Here in the internet, we set up a virtual link through this network. Well, and it is private, private between these three organizations I have shown here. So they all have the illusion, they have their own secure link for communication using the public network. The advantage is simple. They are using the internet connection. The internet connection costs, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 krona per month on each location. And you set up the VPN and then you can communicate as much as you want. If you want to have a maybe 2 megabit link between Lillehammer and Jövik, you pay a lot of money. I don't know how much, but for each of the links, you pay some thousands of kroner per month, I think. So, this makes it easier and cheaper. It makes it more flexible, because when there is another partner connected here, only connecting to the internet, setting a new private virtual link, and we can add another one to our private network. So this is a simple, easy way. What's the problem with this? Or is there any problem? We are using this network, this internet. And what is the basis of the internet at the moment? Do you have a guaranteed service level in the internet? For example, you want to access Netflix. Do you have a dedicated service in the internet? Bandwidth, packet loss, something like this? Is this guaranteed? No. It is all mostly called best effort. So everybody comes and gets a piece of the available network. Anybody heard about the discussion about network neutrality in the last 1, 2, 3 years? This is something that in the internet, if you pay, you get a guaranteed bandwidth, a guaranteed packet loss rate and something like this. So the idea behind this is, first, the stock owners of these companies like Telenor and Deutsche Telekom and France Telecom and Orange and so on, they want to make more money. And the other thing is that if you do not pay, you do not get anything. Luckily, the European Commission dropped this idea at the moment, but it is not dead, be sure. That means when you buy a Netflix account, you have best effort. When you buy a Netflix Pro account for double price, You get also a guarantee that the packets you order, the stream you order, will arrive you in a good quality and time. And this is the problem in the internet. At the moment, we mostly have no problems because the capacity of the internet is broad enough and we are not living in the end of the woods. Maybe I have no idea how it looks like in the north of Norway, where the infrastructure is not as good. Then we have more or less a satisfied internet connection quality. But this could change. So we have the problem that we are here using best effort. We have no guarantee. And when we need this link here for a very important conference between PC1 and PC2, business conference, then it is not 100% guaranteed that it works. In the most cases, it works, but it's not 100%. When you need 100%, then you need to go to Itiva, Telenor, whatever, who is here, and off and buy a dedicated 2 megabit, 10 megabit, whatever link, which guarantees you bandwidth, packet loss ratio, and whatever. But using this, you don't have this guarantee. This you have to take into mind. But for the most, 98%, 99% of the applications, this will be okay. If you, this is a bank, and this is a bank, and this is a bank, it's not okay. Because they need huge high reliability and security, for example, a bank. But for normal companies, it's okay. You also need to know how much does a VPN connection cost and how much does a direct link cost. And when the direct link costs more than the revenue of a month for you, you cannot buy. Okay. In the virtual private network, we have two modes, and you need to understand these two modes. I don't go too deep in detail. One mode is called tunnel mode. The analogy is like this. We have a car, and we want to transfer the car from Hirtshals to Lavik. And the car is the packet. So we put the car into the boat, transfer it on the other side, and put it out. This is the classical tunnel mode. In the VPN, we put our IP packet into a new IP packet, transfer it, and at the end, we disassemble this IP packet and have it back. It's like a ferry. You can put things like this. For the tunnel mode, the organization established two perimeter tunnel servers. Between these tunnel servers, they act as encryption point. The ship is something like the encryption. You could imagine there's a door, it's completely locked, and no one from outside is able to get in. Also, the pirates from Namibia are not coming in. So, this is how it works. Primary benefits of this model is that the intercepted packet reveals nothing about true destination system. So, the packet is put in, and the ship is going, and the packet does not know where the ship is going. It's only hoping, okay, when I'm there, I will be reach Lavik, but maybe... does not know. Example for tunnel modes is Microsoft Internet Security and Acceleration, ISAS server. There you can set up tunnels. But this is one product only as an example. The second one is transport mode. And you should understand the differences between this tunnel mode. There is a separate encapsulation of the packet. And then the transport mode, we have the data within IP packet is encrypted, but the header information not. This means here, my packet, this one, the payload, is encrypted. It is secured on the way. But the header information is not encrypted. So the packet has the same address information and where it should go and the ports, application, and so on. Only here it is encrypted. This allows user to establish secure link directly with remote hosts, encrypting only data and not changing the packets. You will learn later on when we talk about networking and the routers and switches and the way we transfer packets within these networks, that it can make sense only to encrypt the payload and not the whole packet. Two popular use cases: we have end-to-end transport of encrypted data and remote access workers connects to office networks over internet by connecting to a VPN. This is typically someone working at home. You make set up a VPN connection and you can work at home. You as well, maybe you did it, So, for example, if you want to have access to literature at the library, some of the publishers give you access according to the IP address you're using. Anybody have experience in this? So when you are here, logged in at Hague or Antinu, you have access to Elsevier or Springer or whatever. And when you do the same thing from home with the IP address from your home internet service provider, you have no access. So what can you do? You set up a VPN connection from home to Antinu, then you get a virtual connection. From this virtual connection, IP address of NTNU, you're a member of NTNU, you have access to this kind of applications. So for us as staff, this is very important, because when we have any interaction with the administration here, maybe travel cost reimbursement, something like this, I can only access the servers of the administration with an IP address of NTNU. So I need, when I'm, for example, in Germany, I'm want to do my reimbursement for any travel expenses, I need to set up a VPN connection to the NTNU network, and then I can do this work. Otherwise, I have no access. And this is something you also should take into mind. For you, as a private person, where you should also set up a VPN connection? Do you have any use case for that? With your smartphone, for example, when you're traveling, then you have an open Wi-Fi, because all the traffic in the open Wi-Fi is normally not encrypted, or when you have a very low level encryption like WEB, then you should set up immediately a VPN connection to NTNU. Then you have a strong encryption, hopefully. You learn later on that this is also a possible flaw or problems we have in the encryption cipher side we are using in VPN, but this is another point. Think about, normally VPN has a strong encryption. And then you have encryption from the free Wi-Fi, maybe you're in Mallorca in an internet cafe. Then set up the VPN connection to Norway. It's encrypted, you're secure, and nobody in this internet cafe is able to eavesdrop your traffic. So therefore, the VPN connection is also very useful. So what it is, site-to-site VPN, this is the case. Maybe this is company location Jøvik, same company location Lillehammer, and they don't want to pay for a dedicated link. It's too expensive. They set up a VPN gateway on each site, and between the VPN gateway over the internet, the VPN tunnel is set up, and this is normally tunnel mode. So the real IP packets will be encapsulated in the tunnel. Oops. Oh. Sorry, sometimes I'm pushing the wrong button. Here the packet will be encapsulated, and the tunnel packet will be transferred and decapsulated on the VPN gateway. It's completely transparent. The user here and the user here, when they communicate, they do have no knowledge about this. And the user here and here and here and here have no additional software running on their systems. The encryption is only running between the two VPN gateways. No other devices are affected in this. So this is very easy. The end-to-site VPN is the typical way a home worker is working. You have your PC or your smartphone, whatever. Start a VPN software. What VPN software are you using? OpenVPN is one. Cisco AnyConnect is one, which is free. So you started here. You set up the tunnel to your VPN gateway, maybe here at NTNU. You, of course, can also implement a VPN gateway on your home router, for example, and set up a VPN connection to your home and get access to your music collection or video collection, whatever you have. This is a typical way. And then you are part of the local area network. For you, it's completely transparent. It's the same way to work as you are connected directly to this local area network. And then it's also the possibility to have an end-to-end virtual private network. This means that the server, sorry for this German word, it's the end device, The server is connected to the internet. The PC is connected to the internet. You start the VPN software here. You start the VPN software here. They are both connected and use this encrypted tunnel for communication. Here's some more examples. The question is, because we're also talking about firewalls, where can we place firewalls? Well, if we have a VPN connection like this, we have the typical scenario of the firewall between the local area network. It is also possible to place the firewall within the VPN tunnel, then it is normally placed on the VPN gateway. But the problem with the firewall before the VPN gateway is the traffic is encrypted. So this firewall is not able to investigate any payload traffic. Is there any worm or malicious software in this transfer? This will be not detected by the firewall before the gateway. When it is inspecting after encryption, decryption. Yeah, then yes. But as the traffic, the packets, or the payload is encrypted, no. The one possibility would be that the firewall software has the key to decrypt. But this is not a good idea. To share keys with someone else who's serving firewalls or other wonderful services. Your key is your key. Don't share it. I know here in Norway, I come from Germany. And in Germany, the trust is not as high as it is here in Norway. So when I arrived here 3 years ago, I went to my lab down in the Cisco lab. And I talked to my colleagues. I said, no problem. You can leave the students in, give them access 7 days a week, 24 hours. I said, wow. And all the routers and switches, they do not disappear? No. And I do it now for 3 years. The only thing sometimes disappear are cables. And I assume that this is not on purpose because some students take the cable and forget to bring them back. So this is something we renew more or less 50 cables per year. But that's all. And the only problem I have is with this, cheese and tomato sauce on the fingers and the keyboards. But there's no problem. So the trust and here in Norway between the people is very good. In Germany, this would not be possible. So the students have access to the lab, but only when somebody is opening and closing the lab. So this is the difference. But independently, Norway, Germany, never give out your private keys. It's your key. Don't give them up. So these are the way we plan them. Now I'm moving on. This is the last slide. One application for these VPN gateways is management of networks. And if you are finishing after 3 years, you have the education and the knowledge of network administration. One course we give in the third semester is network administration together with security and wireless LAN. And you learn how to manage a network. And for network management, we normally have a completely dedicated network which is separated from the user network. Not to influence the user network on the one hand, and not give the users the possibility to access any management tools, whatever. And this management network is separated in a virtual LAN. You learn later on what a VLAN is, if you don't know it. But this administrator normally is not working 7 days, 24 hours, sitting at NTNU and waiting that something's happening. Sometimes, especially on the weekends and during the night, there is an administrator available if something happens, but this administrator normally maybe lives in Hammer and needs an hour driving here. So it's simple to get, or much more easier to get a VPN tunnel to the network, the VPN gateway, access the management VLAN, and see where any trouble is appearing and fix the trouble, if it is possible, remotely. So therefore, a good application is the management station could be accessed. The management LAN using a VPN tunnel. This is a typical way how network management will be realized. So because this is a very, very sensitive network, the management network. If somebody is inside the management network of the organization, he or she has access to everything. Can change router configuration, switch configuration, can copy traffic to other machines, whatever. Can switch off, for example, encryption and all these wonderful things. You'll learn this also in the course later on. Okay, this was firewalls and VPN introduction. I know that you did not understand everything, or not everybody of you understand everything. It should only be a little bit an introduction that you know what's coming on to you in the next two, three years. So what you have to learn, what you do, if you come to the networking course, we do a lot of these things in a practical way. Because I transfer the lecture to a new colleague, Ernst-Gunnar Gran. He will come in December. I don't know exactly what he is doing and how he is doing it, but I think he will do it in a similar way. Our networking course is based on the CCNA, Cisco Network, Cisco Certified Network Associated. So we have the completely CCNA material here. We have the lab based on CCNA, and we have the possibility for you to get a voucher to get the CCNA certification. You cannot do the certification here because we don't have the environment to do this. Therefore, we need a completely separated network, not connected to the internet, all these wonderful things. It costs a lot of money, and it is not the purpose of a university to do this. But you get a voucher. You can get a voucher to do this for a special lower price in Brumunddal or Oslo or anywhere else. But therefore, I had this discussion very often with the students. You need to do the so-called final exam, it's a multiple choice test, in the first try with a minimum of 75%. And if you don't do it with 75%, you don't get the voucher. Of course, you can do the CCNA afterwards. And you can also use the NetLab for training purposes. But you don't get this vouchers. So is somebody interested in the CCNA? Okay, so many. My experience shows that 10 to 20 people are interested, 1 to 2 are doing it at the end. Take into mind that if you want to do this and learn all these, it takes you 6 to 8 hours every week to learn this stuff. It's an amount of work. Of course, the CCNA certificate gives you a better job opportunity, maybe. But if you are not interested in networking administration, it's a lot of work. Take this into mind. And I recommend not to do it if you do not want to do it. Only to collect certificates for your CV. This makes no sense.